The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on March 27, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everyone. Nice to see you all here. Hi, Peter. Always nice to see you. So this morning I want to give a talk that I've titled, If You Love, Love Openly. And that might sound like the title of a romance novel, but it's actually a title of a story that I've gotten from Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, the classic English language Zen text by Paul Reps. And this is one of the 101 Zen stories that are in there. If you've read this book, you know it's a charming collection. It's got the 101 Zen stories in it. It has the Mumonkan, one of the koan collections, important koan collections in Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, and then the top 10 ox herder pictures. And then there's some teachings after that even from, I believe they're from, teachings here at the end, centering teachings. Anyhow, it's a book that whenever people talk about it, they go, oh, I remember that book. That's a great book. I still have it on my shelf kind of thing. And I had to buy two copies of it actually because my first one was a little pocket. I'm kind of a book freak, you know, and so things like little pocket, a little almost cube-sized pocket book really excites me, you know, so I would carry it around with me and read some of those stories. And I had it up at a cabin one time, and I was reading it on a porch, and dinner arrived quicker than I was expecting. And I set it down, and then it rained, and that little cube fused into an unreadable block of paper. So I bought this. This version looks more like, I think, the original copy of it. Probably more about this book than you needed to know, because I really just want to talk about the story, If You Love, Love Openly. So let me read it to you, and then I'll talk about the main character, the main person that's in the story, and then talk about the story itself. Bruce, you can come on in if you'd like. Okay. "20 monks and one nun, who is named Eshun, were practicing meditation with a certain Zen master. Eshun was very pretty, even though her head was shaved and her dress plain. Several monks secretly fell in love with her. One of them wrote her a love letter, insisting on a private meeting. Eshun did not reply. The following day, the master gave a lecture to the group, and when it was over, Eshun rose. Addressing the one who had written her, she said, 'If you really love me so much, come and embrace me now.'" So that's our story. And, you know, I just kind of look at through here for interesting stories, and that one, I kept coming back to it. There's something about that one that I liked. And in part, it's because of the character of Eshun, this nun that's practicing with these men. So Eshun is based on a historical figure. You know, whether these stories actually take place or not, we don't know. But this is a story that's told about her. And there's a reason why there's a story that's told about her. She is an important figure in Zen, and she's important because she's one of the few female Zen masters that we have a record of. I don't know if we have any of her actual teachings outside of these stories, but we do have these stories. So that's why I wanted to touch on this one. Interesting story, interesting figure. So Eshun lived from 1362 till about 1430. So 14th century into 15th century Japan. And Eshun, probably not surprisingly, because she's in a monastery, she didn't marry. And that's important because that was very much expected of women at this time, particularly of a certain class. And she appears to have been educated. So it seems like she was of a class that would have expected her to marry. But she did not do that. And we know from this story that she was pretty, because these monks thought she was pretty, even though her head was shaven and her dress plain. And I'm going to tell you there's even more to the story than just that. So she was a beautiful woman as well, but she decided after the age of 30, it doesn't tell us when, but so she'd gotten along, not getting married, not getting tied down with family, to join the monastery at Saijoji, which her brother, Ryoan Emyo, had founded and was the abbot of. So she approached her brother Ryoan at Saijoji, and she said, I would like to be a nun at this monastery. And Ryoan actually said, no, I don't want to accept you into the monastery. And the reason why is I'm afraid that your beauty is going to disrupt the activities at the monastery. And the particular article I got some of this history from by Sally Jico Tisdale, it was in a Tricycle magazine from a few years ago. She's very generous in her assessment of Ryoan when she says that the reason that he turned her down is that Ryoan didn't have much faith in the men he trained. Because I don't think that's actually what the problem was. And actually, when he turns her down, at least according to this particular story, he adds something that I think really clarifies what his problem with having Aishin practice is. He tells her, this life is only for the Daijubo ones, he added. Daijubo means the Da Cheng Fu, heroic, noble, grand, manly. You know, manly. This is what really is at the heart of him turning her down. This is a manly practice. This isn't for you. Though he does say your beauty is going to disrupt the monastery. But this is really what's at heart. So Aishin, she has great aspiration to wake up to take up this practice. So she returns home. She cuts her hair. And then this, just hold on, this is a little violent. But what she does is she takes a hot poker and she mars her face to mar her beauty. Then she dresses in plain clothes and she returns to the monastery. And Ryoan can't deny her. So he lets her come back into the monastery. So I just want to kind of back up a second and get to that marring of the face, because it's pretty startling. We hear stories like that, and it's shocking. And one of the things I want to say about that is I think it really does make clear to us the hurdles that women encountered as they tried to take up this practice. And there are hurdles that still are in place for women trying to take up this practice. And it may not be this extreme, at least in the U.S. I think it can be around the world, though. I don't think that this is unique to Zen. So around the world, I think there are maybe more extreme versions. But in the States, it's trickier because it's subtler. It's a little harder to see what those obstacles are. So something to keep in mind for all of us as we practice to realize those hurdles are there. The story also puts Aishin into a tradition of stories about students who had a strong aspiration to take up this practice. And I think of immediately the story of Hui Ke, which is another story we've told here that has another gruesome incident in it. And this is the second Chinese patriarch of Zen. And he was a student of Bodhidharma. The Bodhidharma we know, the legendary figure who came from India to China, transmitted this particular practice to China. So Hui Ke wanted to be his student, and Bodhidharma didn't accept him as a student, even after Hui Ke stood outside in waist-deep snow for an entire night to show his devotion, to show his aspiration to wake up. Bodhidharma still denied him. So Hui Ke cut his arm off and presented that to Bodhidharma to show his aspiration, to show his commitment to waking up. And then Bodhidharma accepted him as a student. So we hear stories like this. I know we do, because I've heard people respond to them. And even when I first encountered them, you just kind of go, okay, that guy just cut his arm off. And you go, well, I can't be real. One thing you might do is you start thinking about whether or not it's real. You think, well, it's impossible that guy to have cut his arm off. I mean, he would have had a cut. I mean, you start thinking about all the things that needed to happen for that to be true. And that doesn't matter. Whether it's true or whether it's not true is not the point. The story has another point that it's making. So in these sort of grand outsized gestures that we have in these stories, these very dramatic and, like I said, kind of violent stories. You know, I saw with Huike, and I see this also in Eshun, is there is that not only that aspiration to practice, but right in that is a readiness to relinquish the ego self, or at least the idea of the ego self. You know, so if we think about Huike cutting his arm off, he's literally giving up a part of himself to take up this practice. I mean, he's, in a way, dismantling himself as a sign of his aspiration for this practice. And Eshun eradicates or, you know, ruins her beauty, which I would say, based on this story, was something that she was, you know, people talked about Eshun, maybe they talked about her great beauty, something that was used to describe her, something that in this culture where women were disempowered, you know, a tool she had for power, this beauty. So she's willing to relinquish this. She's willing to relinquish this. And so then the question we have today, as we take up this practice, is, are you ready to relinquish the ego self? And all you have to do is just start thinking about your life and think about the things that you can't live without. You know, you go, that may go, well, it has nothing to do with my ego. It has everything to do with your ego. Now, what is that which you just can't give up? Now, they're silly, because sometimes there are things you can give up pretty easily. And this is the nature of our life. The things that seem so important to us don't seem important after a while. So now I don't know what I called it. Oh, heck, I can think of, for example, when I was a child, I could not imagine living without Lammy. Now, that's the kind of name that a kid would give a stuffed lamb, but I had a stuffed lamb, and that lamb was a big deal to me. You know, I've seen, as I've gone through the years, I've seen how parents have to kind of wean their children from things like that. I had a blanket, too. I don't know if I had a name for that. But anyhow, I couldn't imagine life without Lammy. That just seemed impossible. I'm just trying to think of other things. I know there was a point when I was in junior high. I mean, there's a lot. No, don't get me wrong. I have a lot of things I'm attached to. But I'm just trying to think of these ones that we can easily see that we get rid of. And I do remember when I was in junior high, too. This was back when television meant there were three channels. There were three networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS. And that was it. But I could tell you what was on television at any time of the day, any network, what shows were being canceled, what shows were the highest rated shows, what shows were going to be coming out in the summer during the season where they tried new shows. You know, I knew all that stuff. I could talk it inside out, upside down, and backwards. And I still remember that I had a teacher who was listening to me recite all the things that were on TV. I mean, I wasn't reciting all the things. She must have asked me a question. And then my television knowledge tumbled out of me. And she just listened to me. And when I was done, she said, you know, Steve, you might be addicted to television. actually, she put it, TV-aholic is the way I think she put it. And then I thought about that. And I went, you know, I think she's right. I think I need to maybe step back from all this stuff that I know about television. So we have these things that we maybe don't think we can live without. And I think we can think of what those might be where you just kind of go, no, just kind of do it. Maybe it's that extra hour of sleep in the morning. I mean, I used to be, honestly, 9 o'clock was pretty much, that's when I got up, you know, unless I had a job that required I get up earlier than that. And then I had a turf war with a coworker once about this job that we had. I was working it, and then they transferred somebody from another department into my department. And for her, even though it was a lateral move, she was actually being demoted. It was one of those things where she was getting old enough to retire and just know these are tricks that corporations will do. She was getting old enough to retire, and they just wanted her to quit. So what they did is they demoted her into my department, and she had the same kind of job I did. So suddenly I had a coworker, and they wanted one person to come in at 6 in the morning. No, it was 7 in the morning. It, to me, it seemed like 6 in the morning. And the other came in at 8, and I was like, just planted my flag down. I'm not 8 o'clock. I can't get up that early to be here at 7. That's ridiculous. I'd have to get up at 6 or something silly like that. And so we actually had to resolve this with our supervisor because it was such a battle. Because she was like, I am not coming in at 7. And I was like, I am not coming in at 7. That extra hour. So what do we have? What are the things you can't live without? Can you not set your alarm at 5 a.m. to get to the meditation hall? Or if that's not the kind of thing we get stuck on, is in the back of your head some idea that you're still going to, I don't know how to put this, be somebody, you know? You're going to be famous. That one might not be something that are on a lot of people's mind, but I remember somebody who used to teach here who just said, yeah, I still want to be famous, you know, and it is helpful to recognize that, you know. I think about, you know, people can even take up this practice and think, I'm going to be well known for this. I just think of that great story Norm talks about, thinking about if he woke up, if he had an enlightenment experience, what it would be like then to go to his class reunion. You know, yep, I got enlightenment. So we can do that with this practice as well. What do you have that's clinging on? You know, are you actually hanging on to that ego self? Is there something, again, that you aspire toward that you just can't give up, that aspiration? Or is there something that you just can't give up that you feel like you possess? And I want to point out that there's actually nothing wrong with not being ready to relinquish your ego self. Absolutely nothing wrong with it. You know, you just have to be aware that that's there. And that's the thing, is it actually is, it's there more than we think it is. We think we've given it up. Charlotte Joko Beck, the great Zen teacher from the sort of late part of the 20th century. She told a story about how, you know, people go to a sesshin and then they're sure that they're, whatever you want to call it, like that they've let go of their ego. And she said, and then I've seen these people get criticized for something. And it's right there. It's not that the ego is always there, but it's right there for us to not know that we're still hanging on to something. And you'll see it flare up at that moment. So there's nothing wrong with hanging on to that ego self, or even not wanting to relinquish it. Our practice is not to relinquish the ego self. That's not what our practice is. Though, if you truly take up this practice, the ego self will be relinquished, or at least our idea of what the ego self is. We start to see things differently. We realize that the things that we thought were going on, and the things that we thought were really important to us, aren't really what we think they are. They aren't really what we think they are. So when we take up this practice to be here, to live this, fully live this right now, and not resist it, not fight with it, not play with it, not, but to actually see it for what it is and to live this, that's our practice. And that might mean seeing our ego self. Somebody's criticizing us, and right there it is. It's to see that. It's not to deny that. Or try to get rid of it. It's actually, there it is. There it is. Now what do you do? So if you're, that ego self is just kind of showing up, and it's calling the shots, it just starts doing things to make it better for itself. That's just what it does. You know, but if we can see what's going on, it doesn't have to call the shots. So how do we see it? Well, you can see it in those moments where, you know, as Joko Beck was describing, suddenly there's anger that's showing up. or there's some kind of defensiveness that's showing up. If that's going on, you know there's some self in there that feels threatened. And I'm usually in the middle of defending myself before I realize I'm doing that. It's like, wait a minute, I don't have to say this. At least don't have to say it this way. It doesn't have to have this flavor to it. And we can see those preferences I was talking about. Do we prefer not to? Now, is that what Bartleby the Scrivener, is that his little phrase, you know, the Melville story? Does he keep saying, I prefer not to? They ask him to do things and he says, I prefer not to. So, you know, what are those preferences? What is it that you would prefer not to do or that you would prefer to do? Again, not wrong to have preferences, but this is where you can start to see the ego showing up. When you're really leaning in towards something or you're kind of pulling back from something, and you can see that that ego self is there. Or maybe you're holding on to a point of view. And the way that shows up for us is we know we're right and that somebody else is wrong. And we articulate it in that way if we're kind. Usually we might state it in much more heated terms than that, like that idiot, that moron. How can somebody possibly believe that? Happened on my Facebook page somewhat recently where somebody just said, I don't understand how somebody could believe that. And, you know, I was just being myself, which is, you know, a nice guy. And I just said, oh, yeah, I'm with you. I don't get it either. And then a friend of mine who did believe that weighed in. He said, well, as an intelligent, you know, college educated person who da 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 da, this is why I believe that, you know. And you know, then I had to scramble and acknowledge that I was kind of being closed minded at that moment when I said, yeah, I don't understand it either. So when we hang on to those points of view. So that's when we can encounter that ego self. That's when we can see anyhow that that's showing up, when those kinds of things arise. We can see that there's some other way, there's something that we understand, some way that we understand that the world is shaped or what it is that's taking place. And that's what is going on with this monk in this story, right? He is acting out of ego self. So let's just return to the story then. In fact, you know, if you think about the title of the story, itself helps point us to what it is that's going on in the story. If you love, it says, love openly. Well, what does love openly mean? And we might go, I know what that is, start answering. But of course, if you just settle back, kind of let it be, and look at the story, you can see what I think the story is pointing to, what it is that the monk is confused with. So we again have these monks, and they find Aishin pretty, even with her scarred face, even with her bald head, even with her plain clothes, they still find her pretty. And I just want to stress, this is the kind of thing you go, okay, well, monks aren't supposed to have these kind of feelings. And these are bad feelings. Having this kind of desire is something that maybe we got to clamp down on, that you don't have to go there, right? There's nothing wrong with finding somebody pretty or handsome or cute. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. We know that, but you start putting it into this kind of context, or you put it in a discussion about spirituality or religion of some kind, of people start going, okay, well, they don't believe in that. They think you should get rid of it. No, none of that is going on. This is what we have. You know, you find somebody pretty or handsome or cute, can kind of light you up a little bit. Be kind of a lovely feeling that seems to arise along with that. It's when we start to do things with that, that then there starts to be a proliferation of confusion, and there can even be some harm that can arise from that. So what we do, generally speaking, is that good feeling arises, and we may ascribe it to somebody who we think is attractive, we kind of light up. There's that lightness, you know, of being around this person, perhaps, but with this, a good feeling. So we might say, you know, this makes me feel good. And you start to hear that me in there. This makes me feel good. How, like I put it this way in my talk, in my notes, but you know, how do I do that again? And that's not really what we ask. It's sort of like, how do I keep this feeling going? You know, how do I just keep this lightness, this illumination, this joy. How do I keep this going? So then we think about, how do you hold on to that? And of course, if you think about it, while you're having these feelings, this is all about me. So if you can kind of settle into that, you can see this is all about me. How do I keep this going? How do I feel like this? And you can even think, for example, well, I'll do some nice things for this person, you know. But when you're acting out of this me, even when you're doing those supposedly kind acts, they're designed, whether they're conscious or not, to, you know, keep that attractive person around you, that person that you like to be around, keep them around you, or maybe even make them like you. So you do things you think are maybe for that person, but they, because they're coming out of that sense of me and how do I keep this feeling alive, they are mired in me. And the next thing you know, there you are, sending a person a secret note in a monastery for a tryst, right? This is all about the monk, what is going on here. I mean, we could actually look at this and say, you know, the monk does not know at all if Aishun reciprocates. You know, she doesn't, we don't know, he doesn't know if she's interested. And, you know, we can just look at the situation and start to answer that and go, you know, for love notes to be passed around, it's probably not something she's looking for. I'll put it that way. I mean, she's not at a bar or in a club, to put it in modern terms, right? She's at a monastery, and she showed great aspiration to take up this way, not to get distracted by things, but to really take up this way, to do what it is that she's doing. So the monk doesn't know, and we don't know. The story doesn't tell us that. It's unimportant because it doesn't really matter to the monk. It might seem to us like that matters, but it really doesn't, because this is really about the monk and what the monk wants. So it almost doesn't matter. He's just trying to keep that flame alive. What matters is his pleasure, trying to keep it alive, what he desires. Now, there's something that happens. The monk is probably doing this, and it's very common to do. So you get this feeling, you know, that lovely feeling, and we desire to have that feeling continue. And then the desire, that feeling, gets attributed to what we're ascribing that desire to. So the monk is going, oh, Aishun is making me feel this way, and I get this feeling. So Aishun is making me feel this way. So he's starting to ascribe that attraction to Aishun, right? He's already got a whole lot of stuff going on here, right? There's this pleasure, and it's his pleasure, right? And he wants it. He wants it to continue. He thinks he has this pleasure, but he desires for the pleasure to be more than it is, to be kind of unending rather than the way it tends to be, which is it shows up, it goes away. So he wants this to continue. And then he attributes this feeling, these feelings, this desire to the object of his love, or at least his desire, Aishun. So his love, to go back to the title, if you love love openly, his love is not open love. His love is a closed love. His love is, well, it's a grasping hand, right? It's something that's trying to get hold of something. Love is a thing for him. It's this thing that he has. Aishun is a thing for him. He's objectified her. He's the subject. He's the lover. She's the object. She's the thing that's loved. He possesses his love, or at least he believes he possesses his love. And in turn, he's possessed by love, right? So that thing that he thinks he possesses is actually now controlling, because he's got these ideas. So what is it that's going on here? Okay, so this is what I need to do in order for this to happen. And in doing that, it's kind of a contradictory sense. He wants to possess his love, or rather the object of his love. So what we see with this monk is he's acting out of a fragmented understanding of the world, right? That's all broken up into love and Aishun and himself. And, you know, it's a world that's broken up into things, and it's a world that should look familiar to us. This is the way the world shows up to us. It's the way we often understand the world to be. Buddhism does not act us. Buddhist practice doesn't ask us to ignore or get rid of that. I think there's sometimes a sense that what Buddhism is trying to do is get you to ignore that this stuff is showing up. Not at all. It's to be aware that this is how I say you're putting the world together. It doesn't matter. You don't have to put it that way. You just have to realize that's what's showing up right now. That's what's showing up right now. So notice that that is what's showing up. And I stress that because, again, I just want to make clear that Buddhism isn't asking us to get rid of this. The practice isn't about turning that off. It's about actually what's living here now. But that is what's actually here now. And if we're actually living what's here now, then there is a letting go of that, living solely out of our conceptualizations of the world, out of our feelings or our hunches or our ideas or our senses of what it is that's taking place. So in living what's actually taking place here now, we don't mistake our notions of what's actually taking place for what's actually taking place. Does that make sense? So we don't, when we're actually just living what's taking place here, we're not caught up in our ideas about it. But when we are caught up in our ideas about it, we notice that that's what's happening. We see, and you see this actually, to put it very simply, you know, if you think about your meditation practice, that's what we're doing, you know, in the meditation practice is, you know, we're told, just pay attention to what's showing up. And that's a whole lot of stuff. A lot of times we'll talk about, I know Kate has mentioned this in our study group on Thursdays, when we talk about this, often we'll say, hey, watch it when a thought arises. You know, and when a thought arises, you find yourself getting caught up in it. It's really just notice when you're lost in thought. You know, if a thought arises, yeah, you notice it. How often can we just let a thought, or instead we kind of grab hold of it and just next thing we know, some time has gone by, you know, and then we notice that we've been doing that. And in noticing that, you just come back to now and that thought usually just kind of dissipates. You don't have to do anything with it because you notice you've been doing that and now here you are. And it sounds like it, often what we say is now return to the breath, but you return to the breath just in noticing that right now you're doing this and suddenly here you are again. It's now. So that's our practice. You know, it's just to notice when it is that we're getting caught up in our ideas, but we can also notice that in our body as well. And I think we've all probably experienced that, you know, we're here, you know, bunching your shoulders up or you're tensing an arm or something like that. You can notice you're doing that and you can let that go too. That's the same sort of thing. You're doing something there. I know I've told this story before, but when I first sat something called extended Zazen here at Dharma Field, and it's a meditation practice that starts at 8 a.m. and goes till about noon. And you sit a number of sittings and there's a break in the middle. I do walking meditation as well. But anyhow, when I was sitting, it was really cold in here, you know, and I like right now, my hands are almost numb. They're so cold and they're just like that. It'll be the middle of summer and I'll have icy fingers if there's a breeze at all blowing. So it's just the way that so I'm in here and it feels cold to me. And at some point in the morning, I realized I was sweating. And I was like, how on earth is it that I'm sweating in a hall that feels ice cold to me? And it was only after I left, it was later in the day, and my whole upper body just ached, just muscle aches. And I realized I've been clenching up against that cold probably the whole morning and wasn't even aware of it. Because again, I had a job. I was paying attention to my breathing. That's what I was doing, right? So I was making something out of my breath. I was making something out of the cold. I was making something out of myself. I was trying to protect myself from it. And in doing that all without awareness. So again, our task is really be aware of what's really true. Just be this. To be this means you have to really see what's taking place. And it doesn't mean backing away from it. It doesn't mean saying, oh, I shouldn't be doing this. It's actually just, what is going on right now? And with that, what's the next step? You know, there's no answer to that. But what is the next step once you see what it is that's taking place? But when you don't do that, when you actually buy into the separation, oh, I got to pay attention to my breath. Breath is this thing. You know, cold is a separate thing. Eshun is a separate person. Love is a separate feeling that arises. When you have this, then you start thinking about things like, again, you know, this is just what this story says, writing a secret note. So what does writing a secret note look like in your life? It doesn't necessarily have to be writing a secret note, but it is for this monk. Because in his world, things can be hidden and they can be obscured. Which, of course, we know we can do that. You put something in your hand and somebody's not going to be able to see it. But ultimately, you can see that even in the act of hiding, it's whatever it is you're doing there, it's still clear and obvious. It's still this reality unfolding. Now, which again doesn't mean that we can't hide things. Of course we can. And it doesn't even mean we shouldn't hide things. And that one gets to be a little more difficult because you go, well, isn't that a bad thing to hide things? Well, who can say? We always want to pin things down to this is the right way, this is the good way, and that's the wrong way, and that's the bad way. I think about the story that's in Steve Hagen's Buddhism Plain and Simple about the Jewish family that's hiding in the attic at the house, and then the Nazis show up, you know, and then what do you do? What is the situation you have? Are the Jews hidden? Do you reveal them to the Gestapo or whoever it is that's showing up, you know? So who knows if hiding is good or bad? This gets us caught up in that usual way of thinking, you know? But what we can do is in hiding, is it coming from wholeness? Is it coming from an understanding that this hiding is still clear and obvious way, is still the way of reality? That no matter what we do, it's always that, you know, it's still part of the whole, even if that's rippling outward from that sense of me. So it's really how it is, what intention we have as we take up our actions, that is what's important. And you can see this monk, he's not acting out of the hole. He's not even thinking about the situation. He's at a monastery, for gosh sake, and he's writing love notes. You know, something a little charming about it. It seems like something a child might do. Do you know what I mean? But he's writing these love notes in a monastery to a person he doesn't know at all. You know, or he knows her, but he knows her, I suppose, as another practitioner, as somebody who's not trying to engage in these shenanigans. So he's already got this fragmented way of seeing things, and he doesn't see that. So he thinks he can keep this hidden, and it'd be hidden. And it doesn't ripple outward. It's not part of the whole. It's something that only he knows about. And that's the thing about secrets and hiding things, is they have that dimension to it. Only I know this, or only I do and the people I share this with. So again, it has that broken up nature to it. I was reminded as I was writing this, because I'll be starting a study group about the precepts in about a week and a half. So Wednesday, the 6th of April, it starts Wednesday evening. And so the precepts have been on my mind. And there are a number of precepts that we could see would help the monk if he was familiar with these precepts, help the monk see what it is, the confusion that's arising here. But the 8th gray precept came to mind. And this is the one that a follower of the way does not possess anything selfishly. This is mine, my love, my little note, my desire. And the teaching that goes with that is self-nature is clear and obvious. Right? That's the term I've been using. That's the name of the study group on the precepts. Self-nature is reality, is, yes, it's clear and obvious. And of course that we can actually know that just by, there it is. You know what I mean? It's not a mystery to us until we start going, why is this happening? And then suddenly it's all question marks. But self-nature is clear and obvious within the suchness of all pervading Dharma. So it's just within this. Not clinging to a single form is called the precept of not being avaricious. And that's what this monk is really caught up in, is this avariciousness, this greed that comes from the idea that you can possess anything selfishly. Ultimately, you see you can't. Because ultimately, you see that that self that you think can possess things can't be found. And those things that seem like they're there, they can't be found. And we can see that in taking up this meditation. It's nothing we have to believe. It's something we can actually see for ourselves. This monk does not see this yet. So Eshun is going to give him a lesson. She's actually going to help the monk see that he's trying to possess something selfishly, you know, or that he does actually, perhaps at this moment. And there is a tradition in Zen stories. So Eshun is just a student right now at this monastery, but she is a slightly older student, so she's had some life experience. She brings some wisdom to this practice, some of which she probably is going to have to let go of, you know, and some of which is going to ripen, you know, as she practices. And there is a tradition when we have a Zen master in some of these Zen stories that they teach often other students, but sometimes the masters. So they teach, and she, Eshun, is to become a Zen master. Now, this isn't always true, by the way. We do see stories of Zen teachers where they have no clue what's going on when they start out. There's something charming about that. In fact, we just read in our practice period this morning, we read a story in the Shobogenzo Zui Monkey, which are little informal teachings that Dogen offered to students that were recorded by one of Dogen's students. And in that teaching, Dogen talks about how he held the belief that all the other monks at his monastery held too, right? So it was some belief he had that his teacher then just said, well, I appreciate all your input, but here's why I think the way you're talking about it is confused. And then he kind of gives his understanding. So it was interesting anyhow to read Dogen talking about his own confusion when he was a young practitioner. But anyhow, a lot of times these great teachers, when they have early stories, they teach, and she teaches. So what she does is she just takes that, remember, she gets that letter and the guy says, let's have a private meeting, and she doesn't reply, and she waits till the entire group is gathered. And then she gives her answer. Now, there's another version of the story. I am focusing on this, and I don't know that the detail I'm going to give you matters too much, but it'll give you an idea of the flavor of Eshun's teachings. So one of the things you get from these teaching stories, when people are going, yeah, I remember this, Eshun did this, and Eshun did this, she had a very in-your-face way of teaching. She wanted to make sure that this was going to, like, land. And so she doesn't, the details of this are a little different than what we get in Rep's book. And the description is that actually she, the community is actually gathering for the talk. So rather than after the talk, they're actually gathering for the talk. And the last monk to come into the room is Eshun, and she's completely naked. So you think about what that's going to do. So she's already signaling that something is up. And then naked, she confronts the student, and let's see what the words are in this particular version. She says, well, if you really love me, take me now. It's nothing to be ashamed of, is it? You know, so she's really calling this out. She's really like making this open because she's helping that monk to see how he was living, how he was acting, that he was actually acting from this selfish way of being that's really mired and rooted in ego. And so, yeah, she confronts him, and she, in a way, that closed hand that the monk has. So in the other story, the monk then runs away ashamed. And shame can be a productive thing to feel. You know, it can help us let go of the self-directed, you know, actions that we make. So you just think about things you might do in private that if you were in public, you'd be ashamed to do it. And then just ask yourself why. You know, just look at that. It's not that, again, I don't want to say shame is good, shame is bad. I don't want to go there. I'm just saying it can be productive because it can help you see that you're indulging yourself. You know, that's what's happening here. So she's going to, he thinks he's got that jewel. Steve, again, it's also in what the Buddha taught, the Rahula book, but, you know, the idea of the jewel, the teaching of the jewel, where the teaching is secret, where you have the jewel in the hand, right? So she's got, this monk thinks he's got the jewel of love in his hand. He's possessing this thing, and she opens his hand, you know. He thinks he can hide that jewel. She brings the jewel right out. And in doing that, again, she reveals to the jewel, or to the monk, the selfishness of his actions. So in doing that, whatever it is that was going on there, she kind of thwarts whatever it is the monk thought was going on. So that is my story, or my talking about this story. And I'm going to open this up to any questions or comments that you might have.
Steve?
Yes, Mike.
So when I see that ego is arriving, if practice just to notice that and let it go.
Well, it's the letting go that's the part that is a little tricky, because in a way, you don't hang on to it. Unlike that Brian Wilson song, Hang On To Your Ego, you don't hang on to it. You actually, in a way, you let it go. But you don't let it go. You just notice that that's what's showing up. And then you live fully this moment. And that is just how you see what's showing up. So does it have to be that way? Is the way that whatever, however that ego is showing up, and it's going to show up some way. It's not, usually we just don't go, there's ego. It's usually we're yelling at somebody, you know, or we're, you know, a friend of mine just told me that she really doesn't like to get tailgated. Who does? You know? So she did that thing that people do that they really shouldn't do. We talk about should or shouldn't. This is a relative teaching, shouldn't do it because it can lead to accidents. But she tapped on her brakes to the tailgater behind her. And a guy was driving a truck. So talking about a really bad idea. But anyhow, then the truck got on another lane and started flipping her off. That's, you know, so you can catch yourself doing that kind of stuff. Did she need to tap her brakes? Or was that irritation, was the ego showing up there? You know, and she just wasn't thinking. She was just acting out of, you know, I don't want that guy to do that anymore. Rather than do what needs to, you know, I don't know what she could have done. I don't want to kind of make it sound like these teachings are about, well, do this instead. It's not about that. It's about noticing you're going to do something you're doing just because you're frustrated, or you're doing it because you want to gain something. And then when you do that, when you notice that, the letting go is just when you notice that, you don't have to be, as I was saying, that monk was possessed by love. You know, he thought he possessed love, so he was possessed by it. Same thing with what, however it is the ego is showing up. You don't have to mollify that, you know, that thing, that idea we have. It's just an idea, you know, showing up itself. We don't have to indulge that once we see it, you know. So then you can step forward, not out of whatever it is that the self seems to be saying. You can do that. And in doing that, Mike, then you let go of the self. So we see there's not exactly, as I pointed out, a self that can be found. So even hanging on to it doesn't make sense. But we hang on to it in that we sort of indulge a fragmented way of seeing the world that is centered on me. So, yeah, Peter.
I was wondering about, had the monk shown his affection for this nun in a not a secretive way, but a more open way, are we to understand that had he proceeded without the need to save face or for the need for something to be requited, to him, and that would have been more in line with the way. It makes me kind of think about the perfection of giving, almost like that. If you are to really care for someone, you should be able to show that without a predication that something's going to be requited toward you. And do you think that the nun was trying to pull him out of that and see how what he thought he felt for her was not as he thought it was, because it was predicated on this reciprocation that would happen in private so that he could save face rather than coming out with it?
It's a great question. So Peter was asking about if the monk had declared his love openly, you know, and that's what I want to talk about, because I wondered if I hadn't put it in my talk, but I wondered if somebody would ask about what this is. Again, it's what does openly mean? But if he had declared his love openly, if that would have been maybe less out of ego-driven desire, and that's what she was trying to show the monk. And I do think that part of it, you know, what it is she's trying to show the monk, is right, that she's trying to show him that this idea of love that he has is very close-handed. It's closed. It's a fragmented, ego-driven way of doing it. But it's that notion of what does it mean to love openly? You know, does that mean that you have to be public in your declaration of your love? And I don't know that it has to. It really has to do with that openness of heart, you know. So the monk approached Aishun without an openness of heart. It was a very closed heart, you know. It was one that possessed something and that held something inside of it. So that private letter was a secret letter. You know what I mean? It was like something that really came out of a place of closed heart. Now, loving openly, whether you declare your love publicly or not, doesn't necessarily matter so much. It could be that really the monk might just open the door for her. Now, there you could do that in a closed way, and you open the door for her thinking, she's going to notice me. I'm going to get some points on that, right? And this gets back to what I think you were asking, you know. So there's a way to do that that's closed, where he never declares his love for anything openly at all, but he just does things, you know. But is he doing it with an open heart, or is he doing it again with a closed heart? And how do we know that? Again, that can be very challenging for us, because it's really hard for us when we're caught up in ego to see that that's what's going on. You know, it's almost impossible when you're in the middle of it, you know, there you are in the middle of it. But so that's the openness that I'm talking about, is really the openness of heart. So how that manifests itself, whether it means a public declaration. And I think she did the public declaration because that was for sure going to bring this thing out. You know what I mean? But, and she was doing that because the love was expressed from a closed heart, you know, so that way she at least gets the monk to realize that that's where that's coming from. Thanks. That was a good question.
I kind of interpreted like why she did the first thing also. Like you said, there's nothing inherently wrong with like his feeling and attraction to her.
Mm-hmm.
But by like her saying that, she's saying like you have to distill that feeling down to what is like an open and appropriate response to me. Like if he wanted to share that with her, saying something much more benign than what he probably said in the letter in public, is okay, probably, to say, like, hey, I can't think of the right thing to say, but you're attractive, I'm glad you're here, or I'm glad I saw you today.
Yeah.
No one would take that offensively, probably.
Yeah.
I think she's instructing him of, like, there was probably that kernel of feeling, and then you really thought it up a lot, and put it in a letter.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that the original thing is bad, necessarily, but that's just kind of...
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. So Drew was saying that there wasn't anything inherently wrong with the letter writing, but there was something, I would say probably some qualities that we were saying in the letter that suggested.
I'm saying she was probably saying skip the letter. if you had something to say, that's probably the way to say it. Public and openly, that's not going to make her feel weird or make her situation.
Skip the letter, just declare your love openly. Yeah, there's just something about, where we can get bogged down is the way the monk declares his love. You know, should he have done it in a letter? Should he have said it out loud? And you're right, we can kind of read into that and go, well, slipping letters is kind of weird. Do you know what I mean? Like I said, it has almost like a schoolboy quality to it, depending on what's in the letter. I mean, could have been a pretty raunchy letter, in which case it might not have been a schoolboy letter at all. We don't know what the letter is, because that I don't think is really the point, you know, so, which I think kind of is in your question, actually, you know, that it really doesn't matter whether he said it out loud or whether he wrote it in a letter. She could see that it was coming from a possessive place. How? Well, we don't know. I mean, it's a story, and we only have what the story tells us, but she sees that. So we do understand that she's a person with some insight. So she sees that this is coming from a closed place, okay? However that is. It could be that maybe she did think a letter was not an appropriate way to express it. That doesn't matter so much. What matters is her awareness of where it comes from, and then her trying to show the monk what's going on, you know, yeah, and doing it in that very bold fashion of hers.
That gives him a chance to do it in the correct way. Because like I said, if there's that kernel of like, hey, I'm attracted to you, but you put it in a way that's appropriate, she's giving him a chance to do that. Like, don't just like, I don't know, she's not making him ignore it or hide it. Giving him a chance to do it the way that it's appropriate.
Yeah. Right, that there was a kernel in that expression that she didn't want to squelch or whatever, but she was just saying the way you're doing it is not the way to do it. You know, so we start over again. Because if you're going to do it that way, then here I am. You know what I mean? Then let's just have at it. And I think that's, again, you know, it's a very bold but very striking way for her to say it. If it's going to be that way, if it's going to be the way that you put it, the terms in which you put it, whatever those are, well, here you go. You know, so you're right. That does invite. Now, if it's not that, if I'm wrong, then it still leaves the possibility that she doesn't tell the monk anything other than, well, if that's the way you feel, here I am, right? Because she knows that it's the monk's possessiveness that's the issue. And that's why he doesn't just, he leaves the room ashamed. Do you know what I mean? Like, he knows what's going on in his heart. Or he can see it at least at that point when it's really pointed out to him. So we've gone to 11 o'clock, which means we'll close the questions and comments. So these are great. Thank you so much for your comments and questions. And we can continue the conversation downstairs if you like. I assume we've got tea treat down there today, Nancy. Excellent. Fantastic. So it'd be wonderful to see you all down there. Thanks again for coming.
This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.